yesterday and where we'll try to get to today. And as I go along, I'll maybe just make some salvos of things that we have said that we have to keep in mind, that a much thorough treatment should take into account. So we discuss the propagation of gravitational waves. We found they propagate at the speed of light. From that point of view, these are waves that are non-dispersive. So if I'm looking at the pond and you throw a rock at the pond, these are described by what they are called a deep gravity wave, not gravitational waves. And there you see that the velocity of propagation of waves depend on the wavelength. So different wavelengths propagate at different speeds. So this is why they're called dispersive waves. From this point of view, gravitational waves are not like that. They propagate regardless of the wavelength at the same speed in general relativity. Again, if you open the door to try and consider beyond general relativity corrections, then there are theories where such statement need not be true. But we're still in general relativity so far. We did describe then the connection between those waves that you now understand how they propagate and might be detected at a gravitational wave experiment, and their relation with the quadrupole of the source. We first obtain a relationship between the strain and just the stress energy tensor describing the source, and then we played a few tricks, and I'll just remind you what the tricks were, so that we could connect it with the quadrupole. I mean, this allow us to see what is it that it's really sourcing these gravitational waves and how, and this is why that allow us to connect it with the quadrupole, the acceleration of the quadrupole. So then we conclude that, say, a spherically symmetric distribution of matter or energy, regardless how it changes, it might change very violently. As long as it stays symmetric, it's not going to generate a gravitational wave. So in spherical symmetry, all gravitational waves are off, just because we don't have a quadrupole. But as long as we have a quadrupole that varies in time, has a non-trivial acceleration, then we're going to have a source that will yield gravitational waves. There was a question at some point, that relates to a potential relation between inclination and system. And so let me just bring that up. We didn't cover it, but you can tell, or you could convince yourself, that something like this should be present. So first, when we compute a quadrupole of a source, of course, we choose some axis. So if I compute the quadrupole of this hockey stick, it might be a lot easier to choose an axis aligned with the hockey sticks that will allow us to do the computations simpler and take advantage of some symmetries. But whether I'm seeing the hockey stick this way, that way, or this way, I would get from my vantage point different type of descriptions of the hockey stick, and that is kind of accounted for by a projection tensor. And this projection tensor is defined this way, so it's just a delta, an isotropic contribution, with a correction depending on the direction where you're looking for. And this is kind of the projection of the axis that you want, that we choose to define the quadrupole of the source as seen from the observer. And so as a result, this has a non-trivial implication. This, if you see a system kind of face on, if you have a binary that is going this way, versus if you see it that way, or rather if you have the system that is distributed in this way from the point of view of where you're looking, versus that projection tensor has a non-trivial consequence in that the strength of the strain, how big the gravitational waves, would vary very so slightly. Not by a heck of a lot, just around a factor of two. So that means, and this is something that is always good to keep in mind when we're thinking about astronomical observations, is there is a selection bias. You're going to be more likely to see events that are face on, that edge on. You can see these guys roughly twice as far than these guys. So this is a price to pay then in what type of sources you have, and depending on the physics of the source, there might be things that you're more sensible to than others. And this is something that, of course, falls in the light of scientific collaborations work quite a bit. The other thing that I would just mention, I don't know, for completeness or for general knowledge, is if you go and hear, or if you go and check in the website or hear how sense there is always a figure of merit that people comment on about a sensitivity detector. So if you ask anyone, how is LIGO, the LIGO detectors doing these days, is all they are able to see to 150 megaparsecs. But that's just a figure of merit. They define kind of a standard with respect to which they're going to describe how well the detectors are doing. And that standard is two neutron stars merging, two orbiting around each other at some given distance. And how far, if you place that source, could you see it with the current detector? So it's talking about binary neutron stars, which, as we'll see today, you're going to have a strain that is larger if your quadrupole is larger and your masses is larger. So of course, LIGO has seen events, gravitational wave detections of binary black holes, much further than 150 megaparsecs. They can go to even gigaparsec for the right binary black hole binary. But this kind of figure of merit is just to keep saying, oh, when we first opened gravitational wave detectors, say LIGO 01, it was into 50 megaparsecs, that putative binary neutron star standard. And today it has gone to 150 megaparsecs, and this marker keeps getting pushed further and further out. But of course, we just said that it will depend on where you're seeing head on or face on, how far you can see it. So they take an average, and that's the number they're giving you. And the last funny comment, so if you see events, well, funny to me, maybe not funny to others, if you see the nomenclature chosen for gravitational wave events are GW, standard for gravitational wave, and then month, year, and day that of observation. But before GW was used for gravitational waves, it was actually coined for something else, people call it galactic worms. So if you see the galaxy, there were filaments coming out, I don't know in which frequency band in the electromagnetic spectra. They saw a few, and then it didn't generate a lot of attraction. Later on, several years later, gravitational waves were discovered. People thought GW was a good name, and by the time someone yelled, hey, we had already coined it before, okay, it was too late. So maybe some other name for galactic worms should be coined now. So, but just a caveat, recall that we derived this under some rather severe assumptions. The fields are weak. There was slow motion. The source was isolated. And we also use very explicitly conservation of the stress energy tensor as in flat space-time. So we didn't use a covariant derivative, we used a partial derivative. And something that I went maybe a bit too fast yesterday was what kind of tricks, how did we use these? And so again, let me remind you, we have H, we had it as the integral of the stress energy tensor T. And in order to make this connection with the second time derivative of the quadrupole, we pulled tricks like this. So I'll just give you the first line, and I'm hoping you can then carry it through. So we had an integral of stress energy tensor with components ALP. You can rewrite this by not doing anything. So I just put an I there and a delta. So this just says, oh, whenever you see an I, change it with an L, and then we're good. But the next thing I do is to say, well, the delta, I can write it as the derivative of XL. Of course, these derivatives, the derivative with respect to XI of XL will give me the delta. So again, I haven't done anything. But then I recall I'm doing an integral. So I can rewrite this using integration by parts. So the derivative of just the x times the t is the same as the derivative of both the x and the t minus when I take the derivative of the t times the x. But this is a total derivative, and I'm integrating. So this goes out. So the only contribution is here. But now it's the derivative along I of t I p. And this, I can rewrite using this equation as minus the time derivative of tp, right? So this is dt, t, whatever, plus dii, the same whatever, equal to zero. So I'm using that. And this allows us, by using these trivial kind of identifications, to change the integral of t with the integral of an x times the time derivative of t. And you can play this trick again a second time. to then replace that P by a T, have two derivatives and an XL XP. So that's what we did. And that's what allowed us to change and have this thing, the quadrupole, come out explicitly. Any questions on that? Okay, so what are we going to try and do today? So the first thing is to talk about the energy in gravitational waves. For that, we're going to have to define the undefinable, what I said before. How are we going to define a stress energy tensor associated to gravitational waves when we really don't have the right to do that? Yes?
Okay, I do have a question about that. It sounds like you had a choice of doing that trick twice, but supposing you stop once, what would you have gotten?
No, you could stop there, but it doesn't really tell you much yet. So the goal at the end of the day is to try and say, relate that initial expression that we have H being equal to the integral of T. We could have stopped there, but if we carry it further down, we end up being able to write quadruples and multiples. So here you could say, have said, well, maybe there is something that's related to the first pole, multiple, of the first time derivative of the source, but this includes both energy and flux. When you end up with just TT, that's just your density. So it's a lot more evident what the physical content of that is if you play it one more time. Thanks for the question. The other thing I'm going to say is well, having made these caveats of things that we have really made some shortcuts in order to obtain these expressions, is that, well, give you a little bit of a PN appetizer. So how do we try? If we try to do better, what are the things you should keep in mind? I mean, this is a field, in some sense, or a subfield in and on itself within general relativity. There's a lot of work there. It's impossible for us to cover. So I'll just give you a little flavor of what is it that one thing you could do. And the moment you go in here, there's more than one way to try and account for the corrections. And some very recent developments, amplitudes, the kind of things that Henriette was talking about, is also coming into this field. We'll then hopefully get to a brief black hole review. So I'm just going to quickly flash some very specific things for some special orbits that will come in very handy in the interpretation of sources. And then we really want to go here to talk about how, again, gravitational waves, weak gravitational waves, propagate and behave in the context of black hole spacetimes. It will take us into the topic of quasi-normal modes. And what that is going to be useful for is to describe this late time behavior and some very interesting physics that you can get out by just simply looking at what happens at late times once, say, the merger takes place. So let's try and define what a stress energy tensor is for gravitational waves. So even before we start, if you remember what is the stress energy tensor associated for, say, EM or a scalar field, both sources of energy that we're more familiar with, both having a well-defined stress energy tensor associated with it, even in the context of flat space-time, let's say, both are quadratic in our fields. So if we write TAB for Maxwell fields, electrodynamic fields, the electromagnetic fields comes quadratic. And similarly for the scalar field, both have wave propagations associated to them. So we would expect that the same we will see for general relativity or the metric field. But at the build-up of the theory of relativity, something we assume is that any other physics that is not gravitational is minimally coupled to gravity. And this is what we use to build up. So we just say, well, if we have any concept describing any physics that was not gravitational, we just need to covariantize it, and it works the same way as if we knew or we postulated in the context of a Minkowski background. So the very, and that is at the very core of the principle of equivalence. We're saying we can always assume the space-time locally to be flat. We can do all the physics we want, or we knew up to that point. And so how are we going to define a stress energy tensor in a way that is consistent with that philosophy? Because locally, we should have nothing. And how can we define the something of a nothing? So this, we're going to have to introduce some new shortcuts, if you are, some way to try and bring this up to the front. And this will take us to something that we call a pseudo-tensor. And so this is a way of defining, I'm going to try and make a definition on, under some very specific conditions, which will not give me a tensor. A tensor is something that, I mean, it's an abstract quantity or concept, if you want, that will change its value or its expression depending on the set of coordinates that we're in. So it's impossible to assign any special meaning to any particular component of this of a general tensor, except if that general tensor happens to be zero in one frame, it will be zero in any R frame, because if I make a coordinate transformation to any R frame, I will keep a zero. But we just argue that there should be a way to define, if there is a way to define a stress energy tensor in generativity for gravitational waves, we should be able to set it to zero. But if it is zero in one frame, it would be zero in all frames, so we haven't we would fail in defining anything useful. So instead, we're going to define something that makes sense under some assumptions, and we just have to keep in mind that, careful, we're not allowed to really make arbitrary coordinate transformations because it only makes sense under these very specific assumptions. So what assumptions are we going to make? Well, first is that if the spacetime, if we have some curvature in the spacetime, that curvature has a typical length scale associated to it. Let's call it that L. So it's very long wavelength curvature. So it could be. So we're also going to regard it as being sufficiently weak. The gravitational waves you're going to consider have wavelength lambda that is much smaller than this L. So might be like so. And why are we assuming that? That's because we're going to, at some point, at some key point, we're going to make an average. That average will say we're defining something that's relatively non-local. And that average will come in handy to even try and define these things. So recall Einstein's equations tell us this. So there is a relation between the Einstein tensor and our sources. And we're trying to get to a point where we can define a stress energy tensor that we can stick to the right-hand side in the right way if we make some assumptions. So that's what we're after. We're trying to define this thing. And because it's a pseudo tensor, kind of you demote the capital T into a lowercase t. And so that's what we're going to do. And this is known, or what we're going to derive is known as the Landau-Lifshitz pseudo tensor. So using our kind of preliminary observations, we may expect this T to be quadratic in the fields. So remember, so far we have been saying the metric G, we're writing as, let's say, some flat metric or maybe some background metric that has a very weak long wavelength associated to it. So maybe I'll call it G1 or G0. And I'm not boring putting this sub indices. These are understood as long as we're talking about the metric tensor. Imagine this, there is an AB in all of them. Then there is an H1 here. And this is an H2, which is formally quadratic. So it's of size H1 square. So if you want, I can put an epsilon here and here and put an epsilon square. We can then do, we can keep working with Einstein's equations. We're going to see what we put in the right-hand side. So let's stick this in here. And what we then do is formally keep track of these epsilons. So once you put that in there, then Einstein, the metric tensor, or the, so the Einstein tensor, will have at order zero this GAB kind of evaluated with our G zero. At order one, it's going to be something that depends on the H1 only. Let's see. So it's epsilon G, maybe I can call it GA1, which depends on the H1. And if this G is not flat, it has some small curvature, it also depends on this G0. And then we can keep going to the next order. We're going to have a epsilon square G2 AB. And here we have, we can have two contributions. So I'm going to open this way. So there's going to be a component that is second order with respect to this epsilon. And that second order comes from the H2 part of our assumption. But there is another piece here that comes from the, if you want G, I'm going to call it in between quotes, 1, but where the H1 is showing up square. Is that clear? Yes?
The H parameters,
we don't really need to care about that. If you want, you can think of that way, that you have done that work, they're going there. But you have to be careful, because once we go to second order, now it gets a little bit more tricky to ensure that at first and second order, that's true. Here, at this very moment, we're just doing formal, if you want. And then we're going to recover a result that will say, well, with respect to the first order, you can define this, right, this first order waves that you have obtained that way. You can define this TAB, and then you can say, OK, I'm going to do it in that frame, because in that coordinate, because that's going to be simpler to write those relations. But at this moment, we're not making that assumption. The only assumptions were that if there is any curvature in the background, its associated wavelength is very, very long compared to this one. So now is where we do the trick, or we pull the fast one. We're going to say, well, take this equation formally. And where, yes, sorry.
What do we mean, like, if H1 is a tensor, what do we mean by H1 squared? Are we squaring it with different?
Yeah, so.
Or does it not matter? Or?
So let me just give you an example of one of the contributions. So if you write GAB in terms of a general metric, G, it has many many contributions, many terms associated to it. Let me just call it, just do one term. It's just one. One contribution goes like the G, D of G. So, and then there are many more things that you need to worry about. So what this is saying is pull this in here and there. Again, I'm being very loose with this, with the indices and where they go. But imagine you do that. So you're going to have G0 plus epsilon H1 plus epsilon H2 square D. G plus epsilon H1 plus epsilon square H2. And now you expand this out. The very first term is the one where you have G, DD of G0. The next one, well, we can have only two pieces, epsilon H1, DD of G0, or G of DD of epsilon H1. And so that's what we put in here. And then the final, there's going to be a contribution where this dd of h1, right? That's what we're putting here, because we see h1 showing up twice. The derivatives are not changing the order as far as their amplitude size is concerned. And then we have another one, which is h2, dd of g0. And a g0 dd of that one. So what we're going to do now is to take an average. So we're going to iterate this over a new scale. Let's scale D, which is much less than this L, but still much larger than this lambda. So you postulate some scale, and you integrate over that scale. Yes?
Can you I assume you're still raising our indices as the background map. So the
yes.
last term also depends on the G0.
That's right. So here, yeah, so I didn't notice. They all depend on the G0. But now the key thing is that is okay, that we're assuming is a solution of Einstein's equation. So we don't need to care about that one. That evaluates to zero if you want, because we are in flat space-time. We're trying to see what should I put here. If we're in flat space-time, gravitational waves are going through, and we're trying to define an entity that will kind of keep track of the energy that those waveforms or these waves that are propagating are accounted for or contributed to in the space-time. So that is a solution without anything. We're in vacuum. So that is a zero. So that one doesn't contribute. When I take the average, notice that H1 is showing up linearly. So it's just coming cleanly. But if I'm iterating over many wavelengths of these, because I'm iterating over a scale D, this one averages to zero. So this one is gone. And then the only one that survives is kind of this combination. And what we're trying to do is define what this thing turns out to be. And a quick wiggly calculation will tell us, oops. Okay, now this has to be zero, because that evaluated to zero, this iterates to zero, and this has an average, which I cannot pull in. I mean, the reason I said this is the useful thing about this being linear is the average is on the outside, but I can bring it inside because it comes in linear. But I cannot do that here. I can't do it in the H2 because H2 is showing up linearly, but not there. And this has to be equal to zero. So I can shove this from the left-hand side into the right-hand side and say that this is going to be my TAB. So the Landau-Lifshitz pseudo tensor for gravitational waves is that, is to say, oh, this is my left-hand side, this is my GAB, and then this becomes my stress energy tensor. And when you do that, then this tau, this TAB, ends up being, and here is where we make contact with your question. This is where we can say, oh, I'm thinking that I have done the calculations to leading order in the transfer traceless free traceless gauge, and this just turns out to be the average of grad A HTT CD times DB HTT CD. And there's 1 over 32 pi. Yes?
Is this a full space-time average?
No, this is, well, at every point of the space-time, you're doing at every point you're doing an average, but over some length scale. So it's non-local in that sense.
Some length scale.
Yes, which has to be smaller than the scale of your background curvature, but larger than the scale of your wiggles. Yes?
G0 is theta,
flat space. It doesn't have to. So it's a metric that satisfies Einstein's equations to zeroth order that has weak curvature in some sense. But because we're taking this very long wavelength assumption, it is weak curvature from that point of view. So this one, we're just asking it to be a solution of Einstein's equation. Over that, waveforms are propagating. Of course, what we derive, those expressions explicitly with, assume that to leading order that metric was flat. So in the context where we derive this, yes, you can assume that that's a flat metric because that's the context in which we are working for the moment. Remember, I had the side comment as what happens if you now considering that the metric, background metric has some curvature, and we did discuss, okay, now you can have propagation within the light cone, et cetera, and a similar argument you can make here and define this. But as I said, this is not a very rigorously defined way. One has to be careful with the interpretation. And interpretation is that if you are sufficiently far, and again, you are trying to make contact with that assumption that works for all the other kind of physics description where you're minimally coupled, then you say, well, locally, I can do my calculations assuming the metric is flat, but there is some energy that is contributed to by the wave, by the waves that are propagating through, which are coming from here. So let's, yes?
Why do we consider H2?
Why do we consider H2? Okay, so let me. So for many reasons. So first, in analogy with electromagnetism and scalar fields, the stress energy tensor there, and these are two theories that had waves, wave propagation, the stress energy tensor was second order in the metric tensor itself, right? So that we can only go look for it this far.
But am I right thinking about this expansion like as a Taylor? I mean, we have the solution and we expand around the solution.
You want to think of it as a Taylor?
Zero, and then we expand around the G0. So I would say the higher order corrections are given by higher powers of H, not new variables.
Well, okay, so that there, you're thinking of a different way of doing the perturbation expansion. That is perfectly fine. But let me go with you there. So we already have postulated. The other thing that we're trying to go about around is, well, we know that locally we can always set the space-time to be flat. And that had two consequences, not just the metric being flat, but also the first variation of it being flat, which we said, oh, the one consequence of that is Christoffel symbols are zero. But if I think of my expansion, this expansion of a Taylor expansion, then this guy is zero locally at that point. So I need to go this far before I can see something non-zero. The same thing, the curvature of the waveforms, remember? The curvature in the space-time is encoded in that.
No, I just would say that H2 is just H1 squared. I don't understand.
So there are two. So you could have, this is what we have here, this contribution.
Okay.
If you want, if I ask, what's the thing that determines, and I mean, this comes out and will come out later with when we discuss black hole perturbations. So the second order, change of the metric G is sourced by whatever is sourcing the curvature in the spacetime, but also by the back reaction, if you want, of the H1. And that's what shows up in here. The H1 square is that term. So H2 is sourced by what is going on in the spacetime, but also what the first order correction square is. So it's that's what it's sourcing. And this is why the expression is saying, remember, what this whole program is saying is that you can interpret any correction to your flat metric, if in the case of where we're thinking that the background metric is flat, as being sourced by the energy carried by the waveform, the waves that are propagating that you already kind of accounted for at first order, but they come in to second order. So, and this goes to the question I have here, where I say, well, what's the bookkeeping of orders? So to order zero, we just had the G. To order one, H1 shows up by itself, but that's sourcing nothing. And we're getting rid of it by this integral. So we already kind of say that the only way we're gonna make sense of energy is if we consider some at least non-local quantity, because if it is precisely local, then it should be zero. And then the consequence of that is, notice the stress energy tensor is quadratic in the way, in the H, but what we're putting here is only H1. H2 is kind of will be the consequence of this. So once we solve that, we'll be solving for H2. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, thanks.
Well,
yeah.
Okay. More formally, we can think of H2 as the second derivative of the metric, right? And H1 from the first derivative.
That's kind of along the lines that you was going to say. If you think of it that way, yes. And so then if you postulate that type of perturbation, this is not what we did. We did amplitude, if you want. But if you want to do with second order, indeed, that's what you're saying. Well, to second order, if you want to think of the second order derivative of your metric, there is a source that is given by the H, by the first derivative. But it better be non-local, because you know that at that point, you could have set all the first derivatives to zero. And that's what this average is bringing about.
Thanks.
Any other question? Okay, so if not, let's try and put this to use. So now that we have a stress-generated tensor, and you cover our nose a little bit, because there is something very non-palatable about this whole thing, we can just push forward as we would have done with any other source. So if we were talking about the scalar fields, electromagnetic associated with TAB, okay, there's a T, if you want, the T00 component has to do with the energy carried or encoded in that field, and the energy density. If we integrate this over a volume, that's the energy. So we can define E to be the integral of T00 in the volume. And if we consider the time derivative of this, it's d dt of that, which of course I can write as right. I can then use conservation of that stress-generated tensor, and we know that has to be conserved. If we didn't know all this, we know that the derivative of the left-hand side is zero because our Einstein tensor satisfies the Bianchi identity. Right? So Einstein equations are written this way. Because the covariant derivative or the divergence of this thing is zero. The divergence of that is not zero. So there's a geometrical identity that tells us the divergence of this whole thing is zero. And this is kind of the last piece, if you want, of the puzzle of that Einstein had to put in to develop his new theory. Initially, he was looking for something that was encoding just the Ricci tensor. But if we're going to put a source, and we know that stress-generated tensors are conserved, then that's true. So here we're saying, well, however we define this T, it has to satisfy that this divergence has to be zero because the left-hand side is satisfying it. It's kind of going the opposite direction. So now I know that. I can then replace this by the spatial derivative of that tensor, the same thing that we use over here. And if we carry this through and use our definition of the ages, this ends up giving us the following relation, that the rate of change of the energy with respect to T is given by kind of the boundary iteration, because then we can use here the divergence theorem and change the volume iteration for a boundary iteration of the following quantity. And again, I'm not bothering putting the TT notation because we're already there. And I'm also assuming that the background metric is flat so that I can raise and lower indices easily. So I'm just putting all the indices down now. The last piece that we have to do here, or that we can do here, is to flip, and instead of having the radial derivative, change it for a time derivative. And here I'm already talking waves that are propagating at the speed of light. So I can always trade a time derivative by a space derivative by realizing that we have whatever solution we have, which is, like, let me say, it, solution is in h of t x. It really is dependent on h of t minus x, right? Or h of t plus x. So derivative with respect to x or derivative with respect to t are the same, up to a sign. And here, if we recall, and I have to be careful, actually there is a C. Because the speed of light, once we try to put numbers, that will come in handy. So when I do this, I can trade this with a time derivative. And so then once I replace also our expression for H, this ends up being G over 8 pi C to the 5. The integral over the volume of the third time derivative of the quadruple. Where this C, remember we had C to the 4 over there, that 5 come when we replace this radial derivative by a time derivative. So now this looks like it's a really small number. I mean, we're dividing by the speed of light to the fifth power. So this will say, oops, there is very little energy being carried out. Let me say a few more things. And then we, oh, sorry, they say pi is gone.
So that's the flux over a closed surface.
The flux over a closed surface is given by the third time derivative of the quadrupole moment square. And so point-wise, the luminosity will be d dt, and this is celebrated formula, minus g over 5 c to the 5 q triple dot ab. And this, of course, means trace or add up all the, let me just write it down. This could be q ab, q triple dot ab of the source. So let's just play a little bit with the numbers to see what we're getting.
Is there a prime or is it just a parenthesis that has not been fully?
Sorry. Okay. Thank you. Yeah. So now let's think of the following exercise for the sake of the argument, which we did a little bit the other day or yesterday. Suppose it could be a binary or it could be a single object, let's say, so that it has a natural orbiting time scale of omega. Let's say we can make the assumption that the virial theorem applies. So v square is roughly g m over r. Right? This is just Newtonian theory. And let's just use that to try and evaluate that in very wiggly terms. So the luminosity of gravitational waves, wiggly considered, is we need to put g over c to the 5. And I'm going to start throwing away all the factors that I don't care. And we're just doing a back of the envelope estimate. We have a quadrupole, mr square. But we need to take three derivatives. So the three derivatives is over, say, t cubed to the second power. So now the time, what is the time? Well, time is like 1 over omega, which then, again, using kind of our Kepler expression, is essentially is r cubed over gm, where r might be this distance. So let's plug that there. And I might make a mess of numbers, so let me just try again. G over c to the 5, mr square, over, so square, let me just, m square r to the 4th, t to the 6th, that would be r. Well, let me just not try and go that way, because I'm going to make another mistake.
You can also go back to the derivation of this formula.
Yeah, but I you know where I'm going in this. Well, I want to group things in a very particular way. So I have g m square r to the 4th divided by r g m cube. So far, so good. Which then means g to the 4th, c to the 5. And now I have m square, and in the denominator, I have, sorry, this was an r cube, r to the 9. And then I have m cube, so I have m over r to the 5th. And then there is a g that also, well, g I already accounted for, m I accounted for, so I could leave it here. But let me just write it in a different way. So I'm going to write this as m over r square times v to the 6 divided by g cubed. So I use that. So I left m over r squared here, and then the remaining m over r cubed, I'm rewriting as v to the 6 divided by g cubed. So then this goes to g over c to the 5th, m over r squared, v to the 6th. And now I'm going to do this other thing. Let me multiply by g squared divided by c to the 4, c to the 4, g squared. So I haven't done anything. But what I want to do now is just plug this in here. If I plug this in there, what I'm going to have inside the parenthesis will be gm over c squared. That's the Schwarzschild radii, roughly the Schwarzschild radii. And the rest, okay, I can begin combining here. And I want to also pull up a c in the denominator. So this, if you do that, you end up with the following expression. The g's and the g's, I'm going to have 1 over g. I would multiply and divide by c to the 6 if you want. Once you put all that together, you end up with the luminosity being c to the 5th power divided by g times things that really are just tell us about the source, the characteristics of the source. This is the radius, the Schwarzschild radius divided by r to the power, to the second power, v over c to the 6th. Where is it? Chalk. So this is where I wanted to get to. So first we started with a freakingly small number in here, but after we played around for kind of reasonably argued sources that could exist, we can rewrite it in this way. This is a number that it could be in the n states of a merger or very close, order 1-ish, so it's not that small. V over c to the 6, okay, it's a large power, but if these objects are coming together, rotating very fast, close to the maximum speed, this also is a number order 1-ish. And then we have c to the 5 over g. So if you, this has a name, and has different names depending on the camp you're coming from, but if you take the fundamental constants and define, I mean, h bar, c, g, you can define many things, Planck time, Planck luminosity, Planck distance. This is the Planck luminosity, which is weird, or is interesting, in that it's the only one of those combinations you can do that, as far as I know, that doesn't involve h bar. So this is saying there is a number that is, could be order 1 in a very classical system, multiplying by something that is somehow a fundamental combination, where it would seem to indicate there might be processes at which you can take a huge amount of energy out, that couldn't care less about where you're doing a quantum or classical calculation. And this number is roughly 10 to the 59 arcs per second. Yes?
Could you explain again how you get the first line of the derivation?
This one? Okay, so these, we're just saying, okay, here is the rate of change of the energy, so it's a luminosity. It's some quantity, g over c to the 5th, and I begin to throw out factors that I don't care, so I just keep this one. And this one is the quadruple of the source, the quadruple of the source, 3 times the derivative, square. So I don't know what the source is doing, because we're just making a back of the envelope estimate. A quadruple scales like the mass of the system times the characteristics length square. That's the mr square. Of course, I need to take 3 time derivatives. I don't know what the source is doing, but I know that any time scale is associated to this omega. So I just divide by whatever the time scale is. So what is that time scale? It's 1 over that omega. And then for this assumption that is kind of Keplerian, or I can safely or reasonably use Keplerian arguments to tell what this omega would be, it's given by that. And then the rest is just plugging. And of course, trying to target the C over, if you want, I can work backwards. I kind of have the feeling that I want to get to the C to the 5 divided by G, and then I begin accommodating things. It wasn't obvious at this level or at that level, so it was weird that I took M over R, I have an M over R to the 5th power, and I split it in between M over R squared times M over R to the cube, but this is where I bring this V.
Thank you.
Yes?
How did we get this, derivative of energy in terms of the quadruple? So
what we did is we took this to heart, which is that expression over there. Then we used this to be a conservation of energy. We ended up writing things volume into a surface integral. Mm-hmm. And then if you replace these and using the H that we had, that we already have two derivatives, we wrote it this way. And then the was it 1 over r? Yes, it's in, oh, I forgot, there's an r square here, or here. There would be an r square, which will simplify this. If you then end up, like say, put it here, and then this is the integral just of that, the angular sphere, and then the r square drops out. But thanks, that's important. But because this one scales like R square and that one scales like R square, it's constant regardless of the surface we choose, provided it's sufficiently large.
But also we had only one derivative on the left, but there we had derivative.
We had two derivatives. Then there is a last one further iteration by parts. Let me just double check. Well, let me get back to this. Maybe I can fill in. Tomorrow there's one further iteration, but it comes out that way. But I'll get to that. Let me just.
So,
yes.
So you have this 1/32 pi in your definition of the.
Yes.
Tensor. So that one is going to cancel out from your surface integral.
That cancels. Remember, we're carrying a 2 there. Then we have maybe the 4 pi. All right, I'll fill in this very weird details later, which I didn't. I was more in the wiggly side of calculations. So let me stop here, and then I will do. Let's put it here. So now, let's bring everything together. I think we have two objects. They're going around each other. Imagine they are equal in all possible respects, same mass. If you want, then you can imagine they're point particles. So for all intents and purposes, imagine they're point particles. Well, the moment one brings out point particles in general relativity, one is in trouble. Because a point particle of size 0 and any given mass should be a black hole, so we're in trouble. So we are already doing something wrong, but ignore that for the time being. Imagine these two point particles somehow do not form singularities, do not form black holes. But take of it as far as where they have done the calculations, these point particles somehow are sufficiently weak that our approximations are correct or can be applied. Imagine they are at a distance d. That you're an observer is at the distance L. Compute the waves. For that, you're going to have to choose an axis. So choose an axis that is convenient. For instance, just imagine these two objects are in the equatorial plane and align kind of the equatorial coordinates to be x, y, and set this orthogonal to it, and then just compute that. And for simplicity, if you want, assume that you're an observer that is right on top of it, right along the z direction. So compute the h. So compute the full waveforms, the full waves using the quadruple formula approximation. Compute the energy. And yes, compute these two things. Let me just make one more comment. what will the impact of this is? So we say energy is being carried out by these waves. So what would be the impact on your binary? So suppose we're trying to make contact with GW, whatever, whatever, whatever that you just discovered and you're trying to understand it. And so first, go very early in time, sufficiently early that nothing is moving too fast, that these objects, we're going to assume that they are point particles for the time being, they have some mass, and you're trying to estimate the waves. The waves will be these ones. But now you're trying to say, well, what's going to happen with time? So, of course, the energy of the system is here sufficiently early on. Would be, I mean, you can just use your one-body approximation of Newtonian two-point particle mechanics. So it's 1/2 mu v squared minus m. This is the total mass mu divided by the distance. What did we call it there? D. Well, let me call it r here. So imagine they're also in circular orbits. So your energy is... Again, we use Kepler here, and then you can just write it this way. So then you can say, well, if the system is losing energy through gravitational waves, what's going to happen with that system? We're thinking about one instance of time. These objects are going around each other, orbiting at about at a distance r. What's going to happen? Well, we know conservation of energy. So dE dt will be less than zero, and is provided by our expression over there. So if we take the e dt here of an expression that only has r, you can end up concluding that what is going to happen is we have a dr dt. Yes?
Yeah, I'm a bit confused here. So does that, like, a calculation neglect the effect of the radial acceleration, you know, due to the fact that you're shrinking?
Good. And so, perfect. This is what we're going to do right now.
Okay.
So imagine these objects are very, very far apart.
Right.
If the system is not emitting energy, it's not losing energy in any way, that distance will stay constant.
Yes.
So we'll start with that assumption.
Okay.
We come in here. We know we're going to use conservation of energy. Energy goes out. Some energy from the system has to come in, which we already started with an energy that is negative. So if you're losing energy, the energy will get even more negative, which means r will be getting smaller.
Right.
So what you're going to find if you follow this link is that dr dt is less than zero. So this will begin to shrink.
Right.
And as you said, we'll have now a radial acceleration. But for the time scales that we could assume, you're sufficiently early that this is a very, very small effect. So you can imagine you will do this in the following way. Take one orbit. You know what the energy of that orbit is. You ask, what's the energy that gets taken out through that orbit? Remember, in order to write this, we did have to do a non-local iteration. So non-local, we did an iteration over some wavelengths. So this would be kind of equivalent or consistent with saying, OK, wait a full orbit of the system. And take that energy from that orbit. So if you say, well, if it lost, let's say, 0.1% of energy that the system has at this distance over one orbit, then start the system again now with that amount of energy taken out in the form of lowering this ever so small. So this will be a reasonable approximation for a while. Then at some point it's going to be bad, and you really need a better calculation that tells you about the instantaneous behavior. But this is pretty reasonable early on. So reasonable that today's announcement is using essentially this. So today's announcement is, for the pulsar timing array community, is that you have a background of gravitational waves that are coming, all at different frequencies. Consistent or simplest explanation is that what you're seeing is gravitational waves from supermassive binary black holes that are so far from each other that for essentially most points that are relevant, the orbits stay at a single radius. They are ever so slightly shrinking, but that shrinkage is negligible. And so you have many, many sources at many different frequencies because they have different masses and different, slightly different separations. And all these are creating a hum that you're detecting through correlated measurements of pulsar timing arrival. The announcements of the papers came out today. There's a whole slew of papers from the four different collaborations, but they're all claiming kind of a consistent behavior with what you expect in general relativity, that the sources might be these type of binaries. Of course, it could be much more interesting things that one can get. The other thing, and this is just, I'm retelling you perhaps what I think Jess MacGyver told us. So this is our exercise. So use this expression. So come in here, you computed EH, computed the energy being radiated by gravitational waves. Now use this assumption, well, that also you're using over there. Go from the rate of change of the energy to the rate of change of R. But you can use it in more than one way. So this, not only the energy carried out by waves tell you exactly where these dt is. Under this approximation, you can know exactly what drdt is. Using, again, Kepler, that relates omega to the separation. If there is a dr dt, then there is a d omega dt. That's the only parameter or variable that is changing. So obtain d omega dt. And this is also related to a question I had yesterday, we discussed yesterday. Someone said, what is the, given a frequency of a gravitational waves, what's the wavelength, right? Gravitational waves satisfy the same as any other way, like non-dispersive wave, that there's the speed at which they propagate. We know the speed of light is frequency times wavelength. So you can ask, what is the frequency of the gravitational wave? You're going to obtain it here. Once you compute, use that expression over there, you compute the quadrupole, you're going to find out that the frequency of the gravitational waves is related to twice the orbital frequency. And it's not too difficult to think of why it would be so. Imagine your face on, and you have these two objects that are going around. So every half a period of the orbit, you see exactly the same thing. I have object one, object two here. After half an orbit, you have exactly the same configuration, and so on and so forth. So if you have a given orbital frequency, the gravitational frequency is going to be twice that. So use that to then relate these to what the gravitational wave frequency is, which essentially is just a factor as a wrench in the machine. Careful, one thing is to talk about orbital frequency, and the other one is orbital angular frequency. There is a 2 pi that is annoying that has to be carried out. So the gravitational wave frequency is related to the orbital frequency by omega divided by pi. So the 2 pi's of orbital the angular frequency and the orbital frequency are already taken into account, plus the factor of 2 that comes from the discussion we just had. So use these that you calculated. From there, go to d omega dt. That will tell you the f dt and arrive to this expression, which is a famous expression that says f dot, the rate of change of the frequency of a gravitational wave, is given by a whole bunch of numbers, which I don't care so much about, times something we're going to define right now. But the only thing that I really care is this. So the rate of change of the frequency gravitational wave driven by, if the system is driven primarily or mainly by gravitational wave reaction, loss of energy in the system from gravitational waves propagating out, says the rate of change of f, f is going to vary in time with this kind of weird power of the frequency itself. So when you might have seen the LIGO, the LIGO-Virgo collaboration plot the spectra, so they plot actually f over t, and it's shaped like that. That checking that it's 11/3 is a very good test that this, what you're seeing, is governed by these particular laws. And one more comment. In the paper today, the nanograph paper, there are some powers that are trying to see if they nail down with their analysis, and if they are related to this 11/3. They're not exactly the same because there's other further things that are involved in the type of observable that they're putting their finger on, but you're going to see some factors are weird and they are related to this one here.
Yeah, so for black hole mergers, if we take into account loss of energy by Hawking radiation, will that affect that and
okay.
be measurable?
Yeah, good question.
So black holes are very far apart, so they have enough time to start to evaporate.
No, right.
Measurable.
Okay, great question. So Hawking radiation for stellar mass black holes, for black holes that are solar masses and above, is completely irrelevant. The time scale, the dynamical time scale associated to Hawking radiation for these very, quote-unquote, fat black holes is just too long for it to matter. People do think about it as potential sources of gravitational waves that are associated to this process, but at considerably different frequencies. I'm thinking about primordial black holes, not these guys. Not the guys that kind of LIGO is seeing, and a lot less the kind of gravitational waves that like nanograv is seeing, or eventually LISA will see, assuming that this gravitational wave comes from these kind of large black holes. It could be a background production of things that have to do with primordial black holes, and then there has to be some funny reconversion for the frequency to show up in somewhere that is within the window of observations of detectors. But for all intent purposes, this is completely classical, and ignoring is justified based on the fact of the time scales associated to Hawking radiation being way too long for this kind of objects. Thank you. And this thing here is called the chirp mass, which is the total mass of the system times mu being the reduced mass divided by m to the 3/5. So when LIGO and the detectors of the type measure masses, the best measured mass is the chirp mass because it comes right on the main observable. The individual masses are more delicate to measure, has to do with subtle modulations of the waveform. So when if you actually see the detection event announcements from the collaboration, usually you have chirp mass is given with a very, very tiny error, while individual masses sometimes is 100% error. So it's much more difficult to nail the masses, the individual masses.
The m that you divide by, that's m total, u over m total.
Yes, sorry. So are we good so far? Okay, so let me just say a few more things. Suppose you ask the question now, okay, we really make all sort of shortcuts. How do we even try and, I mean, going back to your question, how do we account for the radial velocity, if you want, or radial acceleration that will be induced by the emission of radiation considering instantaneously, not through averages? So that is a whole, as I said, it's a whole field in and on itself. But so I'll give you a little bit of a taste or a flavor of post-Newtonian arguments or post-Newtonian considerations. Extremely briefly, but just so that you see it. And again, I think it might be useful or relevant for some of you because in this camp, amplitudes are coming in, and depending on what your smallness parameter, the amplitude style calculations are being very useful in that quest. So here, our goal is now to try and see what happens beyond the flat space-time approximation. And one thing you can say, well, first you start with an ansatz. Imagine, okay, we have chosen a set of coordinates, which at some point we might have to go back to and double check. But imagine there are some set of convenient coordinates. And you, in those coordinates, you're going to write the metric, the time-time component of the metric, as 1 minus 1 plus pi over c squared. The times space component of the metric as some vector, some three vector over c squared. And the purely spatial part of the metric as 1 minus 2 phi over c squared delta ij plus chi ij over c squared, where trace of chi ij is 0. Okay, so at this point, you should be saying, okay, why is this guy trying to do? Where did these things come? Why did I put this c squared? So this is a way to say, you're still a post-Newtonian, it's an approximation. We're going to think the speeds that are still slow. So kind of considering how big things are with respect of speed of light, the speed of light value, is useful. So it's not surprising that c's will appear explicitly. But of course, why this power? Why c squared and not c to the 3/4 or whatever? So this, you put an ansatz where these c's to whatever power are arbitrary, you put them into Einstein's equations and see what powers are consistent for appropriate counting of different contributions. And these are the ones. So I just jump directly to it. The other thing, what are these functions or these quantities? This is a scalar, that's a scalar, that's a vector, and this is a tensor. It's just another way of bookkeeping departures from flat space time. If I take phi, omega, psi, and chi to 0, then we just recover flat space time. And once you put this into Einstein's equations, then you can try and see what is the physics that each of these things encode. For instance, this phi and also this psi is encoding the Newtonian potential of a source. So if you're asking, where does my Poisson equation lie in Einstein's equations, it lies deeply embedded in it when you take the c to infinity limit and you keep the leading non-trivial contribution, then you're going to have this phi and that psi. And if you make one further coordinate transformation, then you can make them equal, and you Laplacian phi equal or proportional to rho pops up. This w encodes frame dragging effects. So an object that is rotating makes the spacetime around it also rotate and has a non-trivial consequence. So that will be encoded in that vector over there. And this is where everything else is encoded, in particular gravitational waves. So if you put this, let's say, remember at some early on in yesterday's lecture, we talked about the action of a point particle. So suppose going back to the action of the point particle, and we write as, let's say, d tau. And I might imagine that my point particle has coordinates c, t, and xi. Again, I'm explicitly bringing factors of c whenever they're needed, because it's a bookkeeping parameter. So then we can write this as dt, d tau, dt times dt, because that's an easier parameter that we're using associated to our coordinate system. This is a length scale, or the rate of change of the length of whatever trajectory that particle is following. So you can just write that in terms of the square root of your full metric times dxa dt dxb dt. And you can use these expressions. And once you replace and you take, let me just do one more step. So once you replace that, you end up with the following expression, the square root of c squared plus 2 phi minus 2 omega I bi over c squared minus 1 minus 2 phi.
Minus sign missing in your square root and the line of.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. I'm not going to write all these terms, but let's say if you replace this in here, you recall that vi is dxi dt. Then you end up with an expression of the sort. You can now take the an approximation of these where you're taking c to infinity, so the leading contribution is in the c. So then you can see the point particle becomes the action of the point particle, minus mc squared plus mv squared. Of course, there is an 2 minus 5. So this is a superfluous overall constant that we always have, we can have. So that really doesn't affect anything with respect to the equation of motion. These are our Newtonian equations. And this is the first correction to Newtonian motion. And this is labeled as 1PN. It's the first post-Newtonian contribution that general relativity has in store. And you can begin to tell, OK, how different terms are contributing, how like the gravitational potential that you would say from Newtonian theory begins to have contributions where it modulates departures from Newtonian motion by the square of itself. So you're going to have a contribution that goes like m over r to the square by itself times the square of the velocities. Again, so the motion will be corrected by terms of this sort. And then you can see what couples to what. The velocity of the particle will couple to this dragging. And the velocity couples quadratically to the gravitational waves that may be generating or departures from general relativity that are not accounted from in the frame dragging or just the potential itself. So remember, we also make this contact where we say, well, if the space M is not flat, you have other contributions, and this is a way, in the context of the motion being very slow, that you can start making sense of all this. Of course, there is a significant industry on doing that, and in some cases, different approximations are more useful. One is c going to infinity is one, another one is g going to zero. This is the one that people from amplitudes are coming into and producing contributions and results to this overall problem. This one in post, the standard post-Newtonian assumes that m over r and v over c are small, and actually I should say square. Again, using the virial theorem, m over r scales like v over c square, this or v square, this we already use. So this is the standard bookkeeping terms that the standard post-Newtonian approach uses. But then this R1 is using G going to zero, in which case M over R is small, but V over C can be whatever. So they don't assume anything with respect to velocity. So the amplitude people are much more, have much tools that are more easily adapted to compute kind of hyperbolic trajectories where the velocity can be arbitrarily large, but the interaction, the gravitational interaction is weak than the standard post-Newtonian. So depending on what sort of tools you use, different things are more natural, you're more easily calculated in that camp versus others. And I think this is all I'm going to say about Positonian. Of course, just one caveat. This is for a particle. If you think that you're doing a photon, then you have to be careful that, like v, what we said here, V over C is not a small parameter. So this expression changes. Yes?
I think the fourth and fifth term, the dimensions don't seem...
Fourth.
The fourth and fifth term in the square bracket.
One, two, three, four. Yes.
They're both dimensionless, whereas we should have velocity squared dimensions.
No, why did I say velocity squared? So
well, the other terms have, in order to match the dimensions of the other terms.
Right, that's true.
V to the 4c squared. And this is to the fourth. Does it work?
That would be velocity minus two. If I'm not mistaken, W had or W, they, it has dimensions of wait. Velocity squared.
All right, let me double check that. I mean, I don't want to hang. In this, because I was just my goal here is to just to show that how some terms are contributing. So phi is order one. This is 1/2c², 1/2c². Okay, this one is probably.
Yeah, those ones seem right. 1, 2, 3 seems right. If there's like you know psi and phi has dimensions of velocity squared according to the previous equation.
Okay, let me look it up. I mean, I'll get back to this. Let me just. I really wanted to get to this other thing.
Is it the idea though that we take this thing, we do it with two particles, and then we plug that into the, we figure out that from this the quantum hole, figure out what the rate of change of the particle is, and figure out the radiation using the particle formula for that, or do we have to also correct the quadrupole formula if we're going to use the correct formula?
Okay, good question. The quadrupole formula, if one analyzes, where does it come in? So it comes in at 2.5 pn. So only when you go that deep, or further, then you're going to have contributions. These will just affect the motion. So you're going to see that now a particle that goes around at an object, if that object is rotating, will acquire a drag that will be encoded by this guy. And then also the acceleration of this object will know about m over r to the second power, as opposed to just m over r as in Newtonian. So this just says that you're going to have corrections to the orbit itself. Now, as far as the quadrupole formula is concerned, it's still going to be the same because those corrections are deeper down in the PN expansion. So that expression formally will still be good as long as you keep your calculation up to that order. If you then go past it, yes, there are corrections. And okay, since see that question, so we had if these things were sufficiently far going to your question, we said, well, there's this kind of kludgy way of trying to obtain what the waveforms are. You just imagine just going in orbit and ever so slightly you're changing it. And the change is so small that it's kind of a quasi-adiabatic change. As they get slightly to higher and higher frequencies, which we have already argued that's what's going to be the case, energy is being lost, you go deeper in the gravitational potential, the frequency goes up, then you need to start worrying about those corrections. And those corrections are fine for a while. Then V over C begins to get slightly larger. This is not necessarily a convergence series, so you put a lot more effort and you have a small gain. There are ways that people attempt to produce resummations to have the series converge faster, but of course any resummation always is with some caveats that one has to be careful with. And this is where, okay, there's a fixed point at the end that one can use, and then I hopefully will describe that fixed point later tomorrow. But as you go here, then higher and higher PN corrections have to be accounted for. So the Hall-Taylor pulsar that was analyzed and signified the Nobel Prize for Hall and Taylor for demonstrating that the orbit of a binary shrinks at the rate predicted by general relativity, used only up to 2.5. But nowadays, people are trying to push from this side as far as possible, because once you try to answer what happens here in the very nonlinear messy scenario, that you need computer simulations, and then you lose your ability to track things analytically, if you want, or quote unquote analytically. So people are pushing that PN further and further. And then so their results are ridiculously high, 15 positonian order for some very simply for the main effects. But once you start trying to say, well, what's the role of spin orbit coupling, spin coupling, people are carrying it to 3, 3.5, 4 PN. And that already accounts for modifications in the radiation quadruple formula, because you're past the 2.5 PN. And ultimately, for some case, things are, in the case of trying to distinguish, I might as well just discuss this here and not go where I want it. So let me just close with a few comments in here. So remember somewhere here, I said, I'll do this exercise assuming the particles, or these obviously are point particles. You could ask, in this order of approximation, when would you know that a black hole is a black hole? Oh, you can do this. When will you know that a black hole is a black hole and not just a neutron star or something else? And for that, you need to carry the post-Newtonian to fifth post-Newtonian order. This is very weird result, which you can argue in effective field theory languages rather naturally. But the result was that when will you know that you have a point particle versus a neutron star versus a black hole? You will only know it to fifth post-Newtonian order, because there is the tidal Love number. So as the Earth and the Moon, we see tides because of the gravitational field of the Earth is raising tides on the fluffiness of our oceans. So you can say, well, at what point will the tidal interaction within these objects will begin to be manifest? And it only shows up at fifth post-Newtonian order. That means that V over C to the 10th power. So this is a freakingly small number when they're very far. You cannot really tell a black hole from a neutron star or from a point particle. And only when you get close enough do you start seeing it. If we go back to GW X, whatever, there was GW 17. 0817, and it's kind of interesting that at some point you start learning these numbers. This was the first gravitational wave detection, and so far only, that had an electromagnetic counterpart. So you saw a gravitational wave and flash of gamma rays all the way to optical, microwave, etc. Because it was a flash, then you kind of knew, the universe was telling us at least one neutron star was involved. But if that had not happened, could we have told that this was a system that had neutron stars or not, just by gravitational waves alone? And the answer is no, given the type of how far it was, because the type of equation state or the type of tidal effects that would be the telltale sign of neutron stars was such that it was very small, so small that it was hidden in the detector noise. And for all intents and purposes, provided you believe that black holes could exist with 1.3 solar masses, the waveforms were completely consistent with that of binary black hole. So eventually we're hoping that a system will be sufficiently close, or the detector will be sufficiently sensitive to see those very subtle modulations, which are subtle because they are entering with this very, very small value. So imagine this object is colliding at 0.3 the speed of light. You're raising it to the 10th power. That's a pretty tiny number. By luck, it's multiplied by the radius of the star divided by its mass, so to the fifth power. So if the radius is sufficiently large, then this one compensates the tiny number that comes out of this one. But then you say you would prefer to see a consequence, stars with large radii. If we don't see any modulation, then nature is telling you that star has radius that is on the low side. And so this is why LIGO and Virgo, using the lack of modulation, conclude the equation of state of a neutron star is such that that the radius had to be, say, lower than 13 kilometers. It couldn't have been 15 kilometers. So it's actually pretty neat that the lack of an effect is just making the difference between, oh, the star cannot have 15 kilometer radius, which was already kind of a question. We, among the potential nuclear equation states, then nuclear physics was kind of estimated it could be a description of a star. That was, those sets were ruled out by just that simple, that unique observation, of which we so far have only gotten one. Because this happened really nearby. I think I'll stop here. One thing for tomorrow, what we're going to try and do is to say, well, I already kind of hinted that this very kind of violent regime requires something else, requires simulations to fill in the gaps. But this one here does not. So we're going to come in here. We're going to refresh our memory, hopefully, of some properties of black holes. And then we're going to discuss how we're going to exploit them. And then if there is time, maybe I'll say something in between. But if not, at least you're going to have the early spiral under control, the early merger behavior under control, and the late post-merger under control. All right, thank you.